Welcome to The More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy that we all get from American politics. My name is Jonah. I am an independent from Maryland.
My name is Greg. I'll be your liberal Democrat from Cincinnati.
My name is DJ from Suffolk, Virginia, self-described economic conservative and self-confessed Republican.
And my name is Kevin. I'm in Los Angeles. I'm a Democrat on the slightly more moderate side. And our friend Emily couldn't be with us tonight, but we're going to do this in her honor until she's feeling better. So, guys, really, not too much happened in the world of politics this week.
Yeah, it was a slow week.
Okay, let's get into the thick of it. What are we going to start with?
Let's talk about those that very social and cordial evening we had last night with rarely any fisticuffs at all.
Debates. I was confused. I thought Thanksgiving was on a Thursday in November, not on a Saturday in February.
Are you kidding? It was like Sunday.
Yeah,
it was a fight club.
Honestly, the only thing missing was Trump looking over at Bush and saying, "Your mother, her turkey is too dry."
I think he did say that.
He did say that. And actually, that was, by the way, and if I get ahead of myself, my favorite line, if you missed it, was Trump saying, "Your mother should run for president." circle back to that. What do you guys think overall? Any clear winners besides the Democrats of the GOP debates? What do you think?
I didn't see a clear winner. Go ahead, DJ.
Yeah, I was going to say this. I'm actually going to go very, very obscure here and go all the way back to the Nova Scotia election of 1999, which is going to sound utterly strange until I actually explain it.
I was about to say the same thing.
Sure you were. Up in Canada, they have three major parties: the New Democrats, which are the left-wing party, the Liberals, which are sort of the center-left party, and the Conservatives, who are sort of the center-right or right-wing party. And the three of them had it was a three-way race in Nova Scotia, which is somewhat unusual. And the Liberals and the New Democratic candidates for premier just kept arguing back and forth and yelling at each other and getting really nasty. And the best line of all of it was from a columnist, Paul Wells, who said, The Tory candidate John Hamm couldn't get a word in edgewise. Voters interpreted that as he was the class of the debate, and he actually managed to come all the way back and win, which means the winner might very well have been John Kasich, who kept standing back, listening to all this, and then chiming in and saying, "Guys, really? What the hell are you all arguing about?" I think there's about 6 days now before the South Carolina primary, and John Kasich is not the kind of guy who wins in South Carolina. But if he manages to play that, "I'm not the one who got in the sandbox, I'm the reasonable one, I'm the one who can bring people together." I happen to see, as I was driving down, I have listened to Bloomberg News on my way to the convention I was at this weekend, and they said Kasich's ads actually did the best among a focus group of undecided in South Carolina. The assumption was that among them was that he just didn't have the time to make any headway. If that's wrong, if he actually does take the next 6 days and puts himself in second place again, then I think Bush is done. And then I think even Rubio's candidacy is no longer viable. And we could end up having a three-way race of Trump, Kasich, and Cruz. And because of who they are, that could go all the way to the convention.
Wow. And you know, the irony of that one is Kasich is known in Ohio for having a terrible temper.
Until this debate, we all saw that because he was always such a scold in those things.
Right.
But you know, with everybody else flying fur, he managed to step back and look like the reasonable one. And
right.
that may be enough. It may not be. Part of the problem is I've said this before in a post I put up on the Open Fire thing that Kevin does, is these candidates are going through what I call different sifts of voters, because Republican voters tend to sift into two different groups. The first group are the competency group, the ones whose attitude is Obama was in over his head, he was inexperienced, that's why there have been so many mistakes, and we need somebody who's not in over their head who can actually get the trains running on time. Now, again, your mileage may vary. You don't have to agree with any of this. I'm just saying this is how Republicans think, just so we're clear. Trump, Kasich, Bush, and to a lesser extent Carson, are all going for that vote. Cruz and Rubio are going for the ideology votes. Obama was so determined to transform the nation, he was so determined to change it dramatically that he doesn't care who he gets hurt in the process, and even if there are victims, he's going to say it's their own fault, or he thinks he'll eventually fix it anyway, blah, 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 blah. This is about this is not about lack of experience, it's about ideology and what the president wants to do. Now, that's very self-serving for two freshman senators, but it also means that Cruz and Rubio are essentially appealing to different voters within the Republican Party than the other four. Which means that is, I think, part of the reason why Rubio has had such a hard time nailing down the establishment lane, because establishment voters are more in the competency sift than in the ideology sift, and Rubio isn't speaking their language. Kasich can speak that language, but the problem is Trump is dominating among the competency voters. So Kasich, at some point, if it's going to be whoever is that person in the establishment lane, is going to have to get after Trump's dominance of the competency vote. Now, Trump, I think, hurt himself last night among Republican voters for a whole host of reasons. We can get into that later. But that's really the dynamic that I think most people are missing. Among the competency vote within the Republican Party, Trump is dominating. And that's usually not something we affiliate with the conservative wing of the party. So people are thinking that his voters are the far right or the extreme right. That's not so. If you look at the polls, he actually does better among moderate and liberal Republicans than he does among conservative ones. The question is, who's going to go after who is going to hit Trump on the competency angle? You started seeing some of that on Saturday. Whoever gets out of South Carolina, we won't know that yet, is going to have to continue to do that. Or Trump's probably going to be in the pole position, or maybe second to Cruz, all the way through to Cleveland. And we may not have a nominee by Cleveland at that point.
Can I just jump in and say something? I think you wasted a lot of really good logic on a very illogical situation. You just spilled logic on a problem that basically, here's how I see it. To me, this is like watching that debate last night was like saying, who won the Rumble in West Side Story? There's no winners that came out of that debate. Obviously, most people seem to think Donald Trump had a really bad night. I fall into that category. But in trying to determine, and DJ, I'm not taking anything away from your analysis. I think it was actually very insightful. But the reality is none of these guys significantly helped themselves. And, you know, I've heard some people today say it was the best debate Jeb Bush has had, you know, so far in this primary season. So if that moves Jeb Bush up from a 6 or 8% in the you know, polls to him doing in South Carolina, if he does 12% or 16%, am I supposed to be impressed?
No.
That's improvement?
No, you're not.
Where's he going? Yeah, he's no. not getting the nomination.
It's not in absolute terms. What Bush has to do, what he has to do, is he has to beat both Rubio and Kasich. Because if he doesn't beat either of them, I think he's done. I think he will feel the squeeze, and people will say, look, stop embarrassing yourself. Get out now, and let's try to figure out who we can back other than Trump or Cruz. Because for the establishment, it's all about stopping Trump and Cruz. And it's actually stopping Cruz first. Then they'll worry about stopping Trump. Cruz scares them more than Trump does.
But as long as Bush has money, I think he's embarrassed himself far enough that he's not worried about embarrassing himself a little bit more.
Yeah, why not go through Super Tuesday at this point?
Exactly.
Why not go through March?
Right, yeah. You know, I've already put the chicken suit on. I might as well put the hat, you know, do the chicken dance at this point.
Greg, his super PAC has money. He does not have money. That's not the same thing. Okay? The super PAC can, you know, say, oh yeah, the super, and let's face it, the money the super PAC is spending hasn't really helped at all.
You could easily
people could look at him and say, look, Jeb, yes, you have a super PAC that can blow a whole bunch of money, but wouldn't it be better if you sat on that money and used it to help our nominee? And if you don't, we will make sure that whatever money you have dries up. And with Bush having the burn rate he has, this is
all right.
He's not
like
in the situation we think he is.
$44 million in New Hampshire alone.
Right. He spent 40 plus million in New Hampshire, and he finished behind Ted Cruz, who spent less than $500,000 there.
Oh yeah.
So,
and Donald Trump only spent $5 million.
Yeah. And this is actually
agree Don't you agree Mike Murphy, who is running the Bush super PAC, who in my opinion is a political hack, a Republican hack, don't you agree that he should be put in jail at the end of this process for malpractice, if not absolute corruption, for stealing money from Bush's supporters and doing nothing with it?
Well, gross political incompetence is not yet a violation of federal law, so I think he'll skate free. However, if I were a donor, I might consider a civil case to get my money back, because you're absolutely right. That has been a complete disaster, and that's really half. And honestly, that has been the story, frankly, of campaign 2016. In my opinion, is that the traditional way of spending money has not worked. Okay? The air war has been as thoroughly ineffective as the air war against North Vietnam. This is the Vietnam War election. Air power doesn't do a damn thing.
Right.
And so that's, you know, hopefully it will lead to changes in campaign business models in 2020, at least on the Republican side. I made much sense to Democrats.
You guys are sure looking at this the wrong way. This guy might deserve a medal that he's gotten so many people to give money for Jeb Bush. I mean, he's a brilliant salesman. I mean, this guy could sell ketchup to a woman in white gloves. I mean, this is a genius, not a hack. I mean, now how they, you know, that's pretty smart guy, if you ask me, in one way to think about it.
That's a possibility. I hadn't considered that.
You know, just one form of genius.
When they do the Game Change movie 2016, Greg, you'll appreciate this. The guy who should play Mike Murphy is Tony Hendra.
Oh, okay.
Who looks just like him. I know maybe the other guys, maybe Jonah knows who he is. You know, he looks just like Mike Murphy, and he has that comical kind of cross-eyed, do I really know what I'm doing look. But anyways, let's get off of esoteric stuff and back to this debate.
So
go ahead, Jonah.
Well, so my anecdotal South Carolina story is my wife's parents, who retired down there a few years ago. And they were up for Thanksgiving, and they're somewhere on the right, and they're not crazy right, but they're over there somewhere. And we always have a political conversation, and sometimes it ends okay. And my wife's mom said, okay, so we've been thinking about Carson, about backing Carson. And so, you know, after my wife stopped yelling, and I was able to ask why, what I came away with was that they don't like any of them, and that at least Carson seems like a nice guy, that they don't like Trump and they don't like Cruz, and they think all these people are kind of jerks, and Chris Christie's a lunatic, and, you know, Lindsey Graham's our senator, but I'm not voting for him. And they were like, but that Ben Carson, he seems so nice. And I wonder about the senior citizen population of South Carolina, because they go out and they do a lot of social stuff. And I don't know that they originate some of these preferences. I think that they have a community of people who sort of talk about this stuff. And I wonder if it really is just about who's not a huge jerk, you know? Like, I wonder how much of that is going on in South Carolina, you know, or just the Republican Party in general. But are we going to see that kind of thing reflected more widely?
Well, I get that quite a bit. You know, I do have a lot of Republican friends who we have this discussion. And you know, they just shake their heads and they're like, look, at this point, we don't like anybody. At this point, we're running an ABC campaign, okay? It's anybody but Clinton. And at this point, they're trying to be very pragmatic. They just want someone to beat Clinton. That's all they talk about. And they've stopped caring about who they like. They've stopped caring about tax plans. They've stopped caring about the vision for their country. There's so much weariness about them. I know most of my Republican friends stopped watching the debates like three of them ago, which is sad because the last two have been delicious.
They've been great.
they've been wonderful. I'm licking my fingers after each one.
Well, having said that,
just want to beat Clinton,
right? And unfortunately, that's a sort of thing that is not going to fly, because when in a presidential election, voting for someone is usually more important than voting against them. The only time I've ever seen voting against someone work in my lifetime, I was four in the 76 election, so I didn't really see that because I had no idea what the hell was going on. But the only time it actually worked was in 1992. And the problem with 1992 is, of course, the vote was the anti-Bush vote was actually split among two candidates, and it almost didn't work.
Right.
You have to, you know, we all really want to do whatever we can to make sure Hillary Clinton is not the 45th president of the United States. But that will get our nominee to maybe 40, 42, maybe 45%. To get to the next six, you've got to show a vision of where you want the country to go, how you think you can get it there, and why your plan or set of plans is better than Mrs. Clinton's, who I still presume will be the Democratic nominee. Looking at South Carolina in particular, I actually think, this is going to sound strange, I think South Carolina has become a must-win for Trump, especially after last night. He needs inevitability. That's his biggest campaign asset, that he is perceived as inevitable. If he loses South Carolina, he will no longer be considered inevitable. It will be like the pre-New Hampshire day, the day or two right after Iowa. It's like, oh my God, he actually lost. If he loses again, then people will look at whoever beat him, and they will go, okay, that person really is someone who could take on Trump. Because, hey, in South Carolina, a state that has a stronger protectionist wing of the Republican Party than most places because of its textile industries, a southern state that is supposedly more conservative but not quite as evangelical as Iowa, which is supposedly Cruz's advantage, a primary state, not a caucus state, so it's just a matter of getting people to show up and vote. This is the kind of state that Trump really, really should win. Now, polls say he will, so he's in the right position, but he's got to hold it. I think if he falls to second, then the balloon is pierced, if not punctured, on the Donald Trump campaign.
Is South Carolina a winner take all?
No, it's proportional, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's proportional.
Yeah. Under the rules, none of them can be winner take all until March 15th, I believe.
Okay.
The problem for the GOP is going down the path of DJ's analysis is that if Trump comes in second, well, there's really only one person who's likely to come in first and beat him, and that is Ted Cruz.
Right.
And the GOP does not want to go into the southern, you know, Super Tuesday states, of which I believe Texas is one, but I could be wrong.
I think it is.
Yeah, I don't think they want to go into there with, you know, Ted Cruz as the, you know, the leading candidate or possibly presumptive nominee. So,
the establishment hates Cruz. The establishment would prefer Trump to Cruz.
That's what I mean. So, yeah,
but that's for the establishment to worry. That's for the establishment to worry about. Personally, I would prefer Cruz to Trump any day of the week and twice on Sunday.
Okay.
And it's not because, and I will acknowledge, now, it happens that I'm one of the very few people who actually likes Ted Cruz, and I recognize him in a very small minority there. But
Wait, you meant to say you are the only person.
No, I think there are a couple more out there. But I at least know that if Ted Cruz were the nominee and it was a Cruz-Clinton race, I would know what Ted Cruz would stand for, and I would know that he is a guy who's smart enough to defend what he stands for, and someone who's actually been in the federal government. He was in the FTC and the Justice Department in the George W. Bush administration. So he's dealt with the Sir Humphreys in Washington, and he actually has that kind of experience in dealing with the civil service that none of the other candidates have. In my opinion, there's a lot to like about Ted Cruz. I don't necessarily think he will win. In fact, I think he would be a heavy underdog. But at least I would feel good about voting for Ted Cruz. I feel good about voting for the trash can if Donald Trump is the nominee. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I'm out of the party if it's Trump, because that says the party.
Would you vote for Donald Trump?
No, I will not vote for Donald Trump. I will not vote for Hillary
Clinton. What about Mike
Bloomberg? Oh, I was going to say, because I'll get you a Hillary Clinton T-shirt.
If Donald Trump's nomination brings Michael Bloomberg into the race, I will have to look very, very hard at Mayor Mike.
Okay. Hmm.
And I would probably, if it's Trump, Bloomberg, Clinton, I will probably hit the lever for Bloomberg.
if I get you a hat and a t-shirt.
No. No.
A one-on-one with Wasserman Schultz. Come on.
No. Right. Okay. No, 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 no.
What if
Thank
we got you,
you
a Bernie Sanders hat that says Making America Free Again?
Yeah.
Or Making College Free Again. Or Making Healthcare Free Again.
Yeah,
or making
it.
It's just a list of things he's going to make free again with bullet points.
Yeah, yeah, Bernie okay. Sanders. That, Bernie Sanders, let's make America red again. Although it never was, yeah. Never mind.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Democrats, unless there's stuff yet to be said about the GOP.
We can shift.
What did you guys think of the Dem debate? That Dem debate.
Well, you know, every time I watch one of these, and I like the audience to know, I always say I'm a Hillary Clinton supporter, you know, so obviously I'm biased. But I always think that she wins on points. Now, I know a lot of people say, you know, Sanders wins on style, Sanders wins on emotion, and that may be true. But, you know, in pure debate parlance, she seemed to have come out the heavy winner in my book. Whether that's going to help her in South Carolina remains to be seen, although I think she hit all the right chords. I mean, she went after the black vote, the minority vote. In every answer, and I thought that she did it pretty effectively, both backing President Obama, talking about the right issues for the minority audience.
Flint, Michigan.
Flint, Michigan, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah,
at one point, Sanders was asked, how much will your, plans add on to the federal government, or deficit or something, and he was like, that's not really important. The important is billionaires, revolution, and he went on and he did his 25-second speech. And she said, "Can I respond?" And they said, "Yeah." And she goes, 40%. It's 40%. And he goes, "What?" And she goes, "Here, here's the numbers. You can go here. It's 40%. The answer is 40%. We'll add on to already." And he's like, I don't know if that's true. And she goes, and that's the problem. He doesn't know. And everyone's like, oh. And at that point, I was like, just kick him. I was waiting. Just kick him in the face and knock him unconscious, because this is done. She's so much better at this than he is.
Can I make a Saturday Night Live analogy? If DJ can make a Nova Scotia analogy.
Oh, you go right ahead.
I think I can put one Saturday Night Live
analogy. We go with our strengths, yes.
That's my only strength. You know, a lot of people, I've been reading, a lot of people are saying, Bernie is so one note that, he better stop talking about the big banks, and he better stop talking about income inequality, because it's getting boring now. It's getting to be too repetitive. And it reminds me of when I worked at SNL in 1984. Well, I worked there for several years, but in the 84-85 season, Billy Crystal joined the cast. And that was the summer where he had first started doing Hernando, or Fernando. He used both names for that character.
You looked marvelous.
Yeah, you look marvelous. And you guys won't remember this, but that character hit very big the, 3 to 5 months before the opening of the SNL season. And that summer, he even had a video on MTV that was a Fernando video. And everybody was talking, "You look marvelous." Everybody was saying it. There were t-shirts.
I remember that.
Fernando's Hideaway.
I remember that.
And so he came onto the show and he started doing Fernando. And the writers were all sitting around going, Billy, I mean, we didn't say this to his face, but we were saying this behind his back. We're going, it's done, baby. It's over. You know, the market is saturated. And you know what? We were wrong. It was just catching fire. And it went on to become, obviously, one of the most popular characters that season, and eclipsed where it had been that summer. And I bring this back to Bernie Sanders. A lot of people are saying he's one note. You know, he doesn't say anything else. But to the new voters of South Carolina, and then to the new voters in the southern states, it's relatively fresh. And he is really good at staying on point, on message. And I think he's doing the right thing for his candidacy.
It may be the right thing for his candidacy, but I don't think it's going to be enough. And I remember seeing, it was interesting, it was an analysis from, I want to say it was Ramesh Panuru over at National Review Online, about why he thought Clinton was going to doing well with African American voters and would continue to do well with African American voters. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that we tend to forget. Well, we tend to forget, particularly those of us outside the Democratic Party. Maybe inside the Democratic Party you don't. But African-American Democrats are much more conservative than their white counterparts in the Democratic Party. They're more conservative on social issues. I don't know if they're more conservative on economic issues. But within the Democratic Party, they will, if it's a tie on the issues that affect the African-American community, and at best it's a tie between Sanders and Clinton, and I mean that as at best from the Sanders position, then they will, if it's a tie on that stuff, they will drift more towards the moderate candidates than the left-wing candidates. And because Secretary Clinton has put herself or has been placed in the moderate Democratic position, that might make it easier for her to hang on to African Americans, because she's not running against an African American who's perceived as more liberal than she is, but another white guy who's perceived as more liberal than she is, and that's just not enough to swing the African American vote. Now, assuming this is correct, and it may not be, then, you know, Mrs. Clinton is in a very good position. I had noticed that Bernie Sanders did very well among the minority vote in New Hampshire, but I was reminded by a commenter that the minority vote in New Hampshire, not only is it very small, but there are twice as many Asian Americans in New Hampshire as African Americans, which means it's not very representative as a sample. So we're now going into South Carolina, where I think the majority of Democrats are African American. This is the kind of state where if Bernie Sanders can win this state, all bets are off. But I just don't see a path to victory for him, because I don't see African American voters in the South voting against John Lewis, voting against the majority of the Congressional Black Caucus. And I could be wrong, but I don't see it. I will have to see it to believe it, and I haven't seen it, so I don't believe it.
Well, again, let's remember that he doesn't have to win minority voters. He just has to do better than 25%. If he can get his numbers up to 35, 40, 45%, that could be enough to swing that particular primary in his favor. And then you say, well, how does he get there? And I'm sure you guys have heard this week. It's been said a few times. You know, the breakdown may not be minority so much as age. And so to those black and minority youths under 28 years old, they may not be as interested in what John Lewis has to say. They may not really know what the black caucus is, the Congressional Black Caucus. They may just, you know, catch on to Bernie fever and go with their compatriots who are so enthused with him.
Yeah, the last straight, and that may very well be true, but if your choices are older voters on one side or younger voters on the other side, older voters tend to vote more often.
Oh, I agree.
And so,
but yeah, again, I think we'll, rather have the
old, we'll see Saturday.
I mean,
For me, the interesting stat out of New Hampshire was how much Sanders won the percentage of women that supported him over Hillary. And I think we'll see if the weird sort of bizarre feminist backlash against Hillary Clinton, like if that sustains or if that was just Madeleine Albright, Gloria Steinem, if they're sort of all women must support all women all the time, and that not resonating with young women, if that continues, then that's a huge hole in Hillary's ship.
You know? I am curious.
Absolutely. Yeah,
that's fascinating.
And I am curious about how many, and this could also be something, how many young voters, particularly young women, who did not live through the political battles of the 1990s. So they don't have the partisan scars that those of us who went through the 90s do. They may look at the Monica Lewinsky thing and say, hey, why did that 50-year-old guy think it was okay to take advantage of a 22-year-old like us and basically throw us over the side like that? Is that really somebody, and why did she enable that to happen? That's a possibility. I'm just saying it's a possibility.
It's a possibility, and I'm not going to pretend that I think like a 28-year-old woman.
And neither will I.
Never understood them. But I don't think that they would look at, if they were familiar or they become familiar with that situation, I don't think they would look at it the way people did in 1996. I think that they would look at it and say, she knew what she was doing. She got into it.
It was consensual.
It was consensual. That could she very was 22. Well be. I just don't think they look at sex that way anymore, frankly. My concern.
Well, I do know, and I hate to even throw this one out. I do know that it was for the most part the left wing press and the internet that brought Juanita Broderick back. None of us did that. That wasn't on our end.
Yeah.
That was something that kind of looks like, wait, she's back? What? Who did that? HuffPost did that? Where'd that come from?
you just touched on the real, to me, the biggest issue of this entire presidential election, not just the primary, but the election, is whether the Democratic Party is going to consume itself, whether the left wing of the party is going to take down the entire, you know, whoever the nominee is, because they're already, you know, it's gotten beyond now, oh, well, if Bernie doesn't get the nomination, I'm not voting for her or I'll vote for Jill Stein. They're now contesting the whole superdelegate system, which I knew was going to happen, but I had never expected it to start to happen this early in the process.
When a guy wins 60% of the vote and the superdelegates ensure that he gets less than half of it, you're asking for trouble.
Well,
okay.
You know what?
But
this system has been in place for 40, 50 years?
The Electoral College was in place a lot longer, and I don't remember that being an issue to any Democrat in 2000.
Right.
Good point. History is not necessarily a good debate point.
No. But the simple fact of the matter is this is just yet another reminder, and I was laughing to myself as Kevin was asking about whether or not the Democratic Party will consume itself. And I thought, well, is that going to be an implosion that's any louder than the Republican Party implosion? We are once again back to the main theme of this election, which is, despite everybody's best efforts, someone has to be president of the United States on January 20th.
I do think that one of the casualties of this election is going to be Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I think that she's on the left. She's going to get hammered. She's being hammered now, and she can't explain. Well, you know, so you've seen the clips of some of these interviews.
No,
and
she's going to get fired. I mean, but every time there's an election, the chairman leaves. I mean, Howard Dean left, Michael Steele left. So she's not going to be the head of the DNC in 2018.
To be quite honest, I think if she would leave like the day of the convention and say, you know what, mistakes were made. It was probably my fault.
Oh, no.
Hey, this is the way I'm doing it.
Greg,
by the way.
No. That would go for a lot. No, just the opposite, Greg. That's a recipe for discord within the party. That's essentially her saying, I really did fix this for Hillary.
Yeah, with the division that we have now, I don't see a... I don't know. I think whatever her future is will probably not be in an official capacity within the party. She'll be a lobbyist or something.
Speaking of division,
she has to lose her congressional seat. But go ahead.
Yeah. Speaking of divisions and the divisions of the country, we had another one fall. We had another one essentially fall into our laps when Antonin Scalia departed this life and went on to his greater reward, and the body was probably still on its way to achieving room temperature when both political parties essentially congealed back into form and started going after each other as to whether or not the seat should even be filled before the 20th of January. This was quite literally a situation where nobody waited for the body to get cold. I know I've said that, but it really stunned me, and it tells me, first of all, how much faster our news cycles are and our analysis cycles and our political cycles, in that if this had happened at any other time, the country, in an earlier time, a slower time, if you will, the country would have mourned for maybe a day or two or three. I'm not even sure the country mourned for minutes before there was an argument about what should be done with that chair.
It happened on a weekend too.
Well, it happened on a weekend. It happened, you know, hours before a GOP debate, but
that didn't hurt.
I want to put an asterisk on something DJ just said. Both parties didn't do this. The GOP did this, okay? Mitch McConnell did not have to weigh in yesterday about that he would not vote on an appointment or a nominee that the president hadn't even made yet, that the president even hadn't even discussed yet. It was Mitch McConnell who talked when the body was called. President Obama was then put in the position of defending his constitutional, not only his constitutional right, his constitutional mandate to name.
His God-given
right. No, I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. It says
you are right. You are absolutely correct, though.
They pointed this out. The moderator, John, I forget his last name, in the GOP debate last night, he pointed this out. It says the president shall not, you know, name a nominee. That means it's going to be done. It has to be done. It's not maybe he won't because he doesn't think it's fair to the other party. So it was Mitch McConnell who jumped the gun. The Republicans jumped the gun. This is not – I'm not going to play this false equivalency where both sides did it. Both sides didn't do it. One side started one side started shooting bullets. The other side just defended themselves.
So I have a simple question, and then I'll let Jonah come in and separate us. What part of advice and consent do you not understand?
Yeah, Mitch, advice and consent after he makes a nomination.
No, it says with the advice and consent of the Senate. Mitch McConnell is offering advice, mainly saying we're not going to consent.
That's not the advice that the Constitution was talking about.
Even
the late Anton. Even the late Antonin Scalia would not have bought that constitutional interpretation.
All right. Well, I have two thoughts on this. One is that I think that the official Republican response is what it was, but the real, I guess, the thing that bothered me was the violence from the left, like how celebratory a lot of people that I know were on social media and how happy they were that he died.
You're always going to get that.
But I'll tell you what, these people are going to be furious when Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies and they get the same thing right back at them. Yeah. And they're not at all prepared. And so that, I thought...
And when Jimmy Carter dies and when Bill Clinton dies.
I thought that was... I don't know. Like that for me was kind of upset. Like these people, they don't get it. Like I don't think he was not my favorite justice. But that's not what you do. That's not what happens.
Yeah,
but now
I
we're
agree.
Just talking
you know,
about social media. Social media is a separate animal.
But if we're talking about sort of public response, like that was
that's not. I mean, listen, we all watched the cable news networks, MSNBC. They couldn't have been nice enough about the man passing. You would have thought that, you know, some of these people that you know were not Scalia fans, you would have thought that they just lost grandpa. So it was not professionals that were doing this. This was regular people who don't know how to modulate their reaction to the news. Yeah. And the correct response is, and my personal response was, I'm sad that a human being died, seemed like a nice family man, but I'm very happy that his seat is open.
Well, so, you know, what amazes me is, why did the Republican Party even say, we're not doing this? You know, granted, we did talk about it would be nice if they gave, like, a day to discuss, you know, what a great man he was, blah, blah, blah. But why didn't they just wait and do the whole thing about, you know, put your nominee in, we're going to block it. Put your nominee in, we're going
to
block it.
Because now McConnell was trying to trump the president. That's why.
I know, but they literally seem obstructionist. I mean, you can't say now.
Seem
the Repu- I know.
What did you just wake up after a 7-year sleep?
I have been asleep all week. I cannot tell you. They literally are obstructing. And you cannot say, boy, the Republican Party are really difficult to work with. Do you have any point proof of this? Well, I have this tweet that literally says, I will not confirm anybody you put. Na 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 boo boo. And, you know. What else do you want? So, and it was hours after this man was confirmed.
Actually,
dead.
I will say, and while you know, I can question the timing. McConnell's reaction and Cruz and Rubio's reaction. Frankly, that is exactly what I want. This is a president who has, who I believe, and I'm just going on memory here because I can't find it, who has said that his appointee will be as willfully ignorant on the First Amendment as he is. I do not want that person
on
the Supreme
Cut
Court.
It out.
Period.
Come on.
You know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the Citizens United decision. That is, I am, and I know,
right,
and
okay.
I know none,
no,
and
no,
I know,
I
know none of you agree with me, but I think the First Amendment means what it says.
DJ, if a Democrat wins the presidency in 2016. It will be because of the Citizens United ruling. It will be because there's a chance to overturn it. You think that's a popular ruling? It may be with you, and it may be with, you know, and I'm not, I don't mean to say this in a denigrating way, with the conservative, you know, I don't want to say friends because that sounds condescending, but it may be in your circle, but 70% of the country is against Citizens United, and the other 30%, only about 15% of them even understand what it is.
Well,
so,
first of all, the 70% who are against it, none of them understand it because they're all wrong. And that includes you, Kevin. I'm sorry. Secondly, this is something that matters to me, and it matters to a lot of us. And it matters to Mitch McConnell, who's been fighting for freedom of political speech for his entire career. That's probably half the reason he decided, I'm not kidding about, because I remember him speaking about it in 1993. This is probably, that's half the reason he decided to speak up now. I don't think it was wise, but that's probably one of the first things that's on his mind, and he's making abundantly clear that this is something that he's not going to move on. Now, honestly, if this campaign tells us anything, it is that money in politics is not the godsend that everybody thinks it is. This could be the election that actually pierces the political bubble and makes Citizens United less important. But leaving that aside, the simple fact of the matter is this is a situation where the president and the Democratic Party has put a litmus test on their nominee before the nominee is even named, and it is a litmus test that I cannot abide, and I expect my party in Washington to do what they can to stop it, as they stopped Abe Fortas in 1968. I expect them to do that. I don't know if they will succeed, but I do expect them to try. And I am glad that McConnell is trying. The timing of that he said he was going to try was probably not the best. But I am glad that he is going to at least try. I don't know if he'll succeed. I don't know if he can get 41 votes for filibuster, if that will last. I don't know if he can get 51 votes to actually stop and block all the nominees. I don't honestly know. I don't know if Charles Grassley can stop any nominee from holding hearings. That is not necessarily something... You know, there are probably ways around that. So I don't know if they will succeed, but I am glad that they are trying, because this is something that matters to me. It matters to a lot of us on the conservative wing of the party. And yes, I know it's hard to do it in an election year. I know it could cost votes here, there, and in certain areas. But you know something? Sometimes you take unpopular positions and you try to move the center to you. And you know who's been the best at that over the last 10 years? The fella in the White House right now. He's done a lot of things to make the unpopular popular because he was determined to try to move the center to him. I would like to see the same kind of activity on the Republican side. I started seeing it this weekend, and I'm glad that I saw it. Would it have been better if I started seeing it on Monday? Yeah. Probably so, but I'm still glad that I saw that. I am glad that they're going to get in this fight. And you know something? If we end up losing, I would rather lose and do what's right than win doing what's wrong, because experience has told me when you do that, you are in office, but you are not in power. Because if you're elected without a mandate, you don't do the mandate. Okay. That's frankly what we saw with George W. Bush. He won without a mandate, and outside of foreign policy, nothing that he did stick. And in fact, he ended up basically doing exactly what the Democrats wanted in most of his second term. That's what you get when you don't win with a mandate.
So my
point taken. So Jonah, we've talked over you. Go ahead, Jonah.
Yeah. Well, my second thought is really that this is it is Obama's job, and that he should nominate someone. I do believe that. I don't think that. I think spending a year without that justice, without that seat filled, there are a lot of decisions coming down, and that'll split right down the middle. So I think he should put someone forward. But the reality of the situation is that this is Scalia's seat, and this and whoever he nominates can't be Sotomayor. It can't be someone that is as in line with what he wants. I think that that he should be thinking more along the lines of someone like Kennedy, someone because he's on his way out, and it's like someone who is maybe a little more in the center, maybe is more of a swing vote. And because I think that's healthy. I think that's healthy for the court. So I think the reality of the situation,
as bizarre as this sounds, I'm actually going to disagree with you, Jonah. The president, you know, if the president might as well shoot for the moon and see if he can get 51 votes. I want to see the Senate majority that I helped elect do what I want it to do. I'm not going to ask the president to do what I want it to do because he was elected by a different group of people who expect him to do certain things. And frankly, the way democracy works is you dance with the ones that brung you. And the people who elected the president expect him to nominate someone. So I'm not going to have an issue with him. You know, if he wants to nominate someone, fine. And if he wants to nominate someone who has his, in my opinion, utterly bizarre interpretation of the Constitution, then fine. Throw it up. And let's see if my guys and my women in the Senate have the gumption and the smarts to stop him, because that's what I helped put them in office to do. Kevin and Greg didn't put the president in office to scurry away. So let him shoot for the moon and see what happens.
Okay, well, let's not forget that presidents always try to nominate someone that they think they can get confirmed. They, you know, Obama was never going to go as far left as he wanted to. He, even when he was making the Sotomayor and the Kagan appointments, he picked people that he felt were liberal, but they were not so far left that he couldn't get them confirmed.
No, I don't dispute
what I'd
that.
Like to do. What I would like to do is throw out, because there's been a million predictions, and most of them are judges that, frankly, you know, I don't know who they are. They're circuit court judges. They're federal judges. But I want to throw out a real long shot, but one that I think you guys will find a fascinating suggestion. And let me explain my logic first. I think what he has to do, building on what Jonah just said and DJ was sort of disagreeing with, is I think that the only chance Obama has to get an appointment through is to nominate someone that he can get some public consensus around, like that person deserves a vote. That person at least deserves an up or down vote in the Senate. Now, for there to be that kind of a public consensus, it's got to be someone well known. It can't be one of these people that we read about in the New York Times who's on the Fifth Circuit in Kansas City. I mean, I know that's not the Fifth Circuit. And nobody has ever heard of that person, and no one is ever going to care about them.
Oh, Donald Trump.
No. You're close. No. You're close. So here's what I think that if I was Obama, here's what I would recommend to him. Pick someone that the Republicans will look at and say, you know, if this person gets confirmed, we won't like it, but we can live with it, as opposed to who might get nominated if Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders is in the White House January 20th, 2017. Because we know that they're going to go far left, and in the case of Hillary Clinton, she might actually nominate Obama himself. And boy, they would have a hard time turning down a two-term president of the United States. So if I'm Obama, I'm thinking, who could I put up there that would have the liberal bona fides for
me
to be comfortable, but also someone that Mitch McConnell might look at and say, I can't say no to putting this guy up in front of a vote. The name that I'm going to throw out there, and I'm going to tell you this is a long shot, Joe Biden. And here's why. He's 73, 74 years old, so they're going to figure, at worst, it's a 5 or a 10-year term in office. Secondly, he was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee for many, many years.
That's true.
And he knows this inside and out. Thirdly, Mitch McConnell likes the guy, and he's got a lot of friends in the Senate. And
that's
it would
also
be very hard for them. You know, even a Lindsey Graham and a John McCain are going to have to think long and hard before denying their pal, Joe Biden, at least a hearing and a vote. Now, again, I'm putting this out there as at a minimum of a 10-to-1 long shot, but I thought it was interesting enough to bring up and throw out to you guys.
That would be very, very wise, and for a number of reasons. One, for all the ones you said. Also, if the Republicans buckle and confirm him, which is quite probable, you could actually have a situation, because then the vice presidency would be open. You could actually have a situation where the president could then work with whoever the Democratic nominee is, and I still think it's going to be Mrs. Clinton, where essentially the president nominates as the sitting vice president whomever Hillary Clinton nominates as her running mate and help maintain the continuity. Now, this all depends on the president's approval rating getting back above 50%, because the president's approval rating doesn't get into 50%. Mrs. Clinton can be in more trouble than we think. Particularly,
but it's pretty close right now. A lot of the polls are putting it at 48-49.
Yeah, it's in the high 40s. So that, you know, that there could be some synergy, a lot of efforts, a continuing synergy within the Democratic Party, or you know, you put Joe Biden up there, and then if you really want to take a flyer, and Bernie Sanders is screaming and whining, just nominate him for vice president and see what the hell happens.
I was just reading this. Biden does have a JD from Syracuse University.
Yeah, he was a lawyer.
But he graduated 76th of 85 in his class.
yeah,
well.
That was a very tough year. They had some really good students that year.
Okay.
So, you know, there's that. I had also just read an article earlier today that Obama, someone was theorizing that Obama could appoint someone to the Supreme Court on a recess and just say, look, I'm doing this without you guys, and you guys can settle this when you guys get back, and then see how they feel like that they have the big enough gumption, as I think JD said, to kick them out of the Supreme Court once they get back from recess, which they'll try, but then it'll have to go through the whole process and get it over with.
Yeah, what we will see more likely is that when the Senate comes back in session, it will never recess. They'll do what the Democrats did to stop. The Democrats actually did this when they had the Senate. They had one senator always there, and the Senate always in session, so Bush couldn't make recess appointments. So they will probably do something similar to that. This is probably, I think we've probably talked, God forgive me, I was about to say we've talked this to death, but I do know that we're coming close on time. So let's wrap this up with a look forward. We have South Carolina on Saturday, and we have Nevada for the Republicans following Tuesday. We have Nevada for the Democrats on Saturday. So I'm going to say, let's just stick with South Carolina for now. Who wins on the Democratic side and your top three on the Republican side? Jonah, go.
I think Hillary wins. I don't know how close Sanders comes. I think there's still a pretty big gap there. I think she wins pretty well. I think Trump wins. I think Kasich might do a weak second or a strong third. But I think that Jeb Bush will do better than expected.
Kevin?
Okay, Sanders wins Nevada, loses in South Carolina, but by less than 8 points, I'm going to say, thereby claiming a moral victory. And that race is just going to be a blood sport going forward. And I think Donald Trump will win. I think Cruz will come in second in South Carolina. And then, you know, I have no idea what's going to happen in the SEC primary, but I'm looking for a brokered convention.
Greg?
Yes, Sanders will win Nevada. South Carolina, Hillary will beat Trump. Hillary will beat
Freudian
Trump.
Slip.
Will beat Sanders like he's a redheaded rented mule. And as far as the Republicans in South Carolina, it will be Trump, Cruz, Bush. Oh my! And in Nevada, it will be.
Don't worry about Nevada. That's right, next podcast. I'm going to go full McLaughlin here. Clinton wins both states, and in South Carolina, the Republicans, it's Trump, Ruby, Trump, Cruz, and Kasich. Bye-bye.